Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is the dawning of the age.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. And welcome back to The Age of Aquarius, the opening number of the iconic rock musical Hair, which just marked its 50th anniversary. When the show opened on Broadway in 1968, it brought the counterculture to the stage. The characters burned their draft cards, took a lot of drugs, even took off their clothes. At first, it shocked many theatergoers, but the musical soon became an unstoppable hit, paving the way for a slew of rock musicals that followed. This hour on Point, a durable counterculture anthem, 50 years of long, beautiful hair.
When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars.
You can join us on air or online. Are you a Hair fan? How many times have you seen the show? What's your favorite song? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now from NPR in Washington is Bob Mondello. He's an arts critic for NPR, and you can find a link to his piece for NPR's Morning Edition on the 50th anniversary of Hair at our website, onpointradio.org. And Bob Mondello, such a pleasure to talk to you. I think it's been at least 25 years since I've had the pleasure.
I was just thinking the same thing.
You know, Hair was only 25 years old then.
Right, and we're only about 26 now, so it seems hard to believe that we actually saw it back then.
It's true. It's amazing. Thank you for putting that in perspective. So I loved your piece this morning, earlier this week on Morning Edition. And when I heard it, I said, I want to spend the hour talking with Bob and other folks about this great anniversary. So put this play into sort of historical perspective for us. When it hit the stage in 1968, it was unexpected because Broadway was doing something kind of different. Right?
Oh, yeah. I was doing things like Hello, Dolly and Funny Girl and Fiddler on the Roof and Man of La Mancha. I mean, all of those have big, soaring ballads and clearly enunciated lyrics and all the kinds of things that we had come to expect of musical theater that was written by Rodgers and Hammerstein, that was written by Cole Porter. It was a very different style. And they were terrified of rock music on Broadway. Rock music had taken away the audience for, you know, back in the days, even when Hello, Dolly opened. Hello, Dolly, sung by Louis Armstrong, became a huge hit on the radio. By 1967 and 68, that wasn't happening anymore. Basically, shows that opened were being subsumed by things that were playing on rock stations. And so rock music was the enemy, and bringing it to Broadway was a really strange thing.
Yeah. Now, in your NPR piece this week, you said, I love this line, Hair billed itself as the American tribal love rock musical. Audiences didn't know quite what to make of that.
What would you make of it? I mean, really?
But then you say they figured it out eventually. So how is it initially received?
Well, it started off Broadway. I'm not a historian about this show, and when Eric comes on later, he'll be talking more about this.
Who actually wrote a book about it. We're going to be talking to him shortly. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a show that started off Broadway, got mediocre reviews, but had big youthful audiences at the Public Theater down in the Village. And so it transferred to a nightclub and then transferred to Broadway because people thought, okay, this is popular. Let's see if we can make it work. And it, you know, when it got to Broadway, it again got mediocre reviews. Most of the critics were like, it's all right. Hmm. It's lively. But the youthful audience came to see it. And then the Broadway mainstream audience came along because the show is not terribly threatening. And I think the nice thing about it, it had all these people with long hair. But, you know, in the real world, if a guy in a three-button suit bumped into a person with long hair, he would find him a little scary, right?
Right.
And in the theater, you know, up on a proscenium stage, they weren't quite so scary. In fact, they were kind of you know, cuddly. And so, the idea this didn't have, when I was back then, I had hair really long, right? Mine was down to the middle of my back. Years later, maybe 25 years later, I went into a concert that was a punk music concert, and I saw people with spiky hair, and they looked dangerous. Mm. And then I listened to them a little bit, and you know, like there's this guy with a mohawk and a safety pin through his ear, and by this time my hair is short and looks like my dad's did way back when, and he looks dangerous to me until I hear him talking about doing homework. At which point, it didn't sound scary anymore, right? I mean, he was just a kid.
Yeah.
And I think what people realized when they saw hair was that there was a certain amount of innocence to this generation, and their enthusiasm and optimism about the world was what was central to the show.
It's interesting. I was really enjoying reading a piece by Peter Libby in the New York Times this week, who was recalling what Clive Barnes, the theater critic back in 1968, wrote about hair. And he called it the frankest show in town. He wrote that letters from readers had prodded him to warn potential viewers what they could expect. Spell out what is happening on stage, he said he was asked. Mr. Barnes found that he was unable to comply fully. Spell it out, I cannot, for this remains a family newspaper, he wrote. However, a great many four-letter words, such as love, are used very freely. I love that.
Good for him.
but Bob, stick with this idea that it wasn't threatening, because that intrigues me, because rock and roll, a lot of people were threatened by rock and roll. There were frank talk about drugs and integrated cast, nudity, and yet it wasn't threatening.
Well, it wasn't when you went in and saw it. It was a show in which people, I mean, the kids seemed variously insecure about certain things in their lives, that they were falling in love. They were trying to figure the world out. They were flower power, you know, to the max. It was a sweet kind of show. And then there's also, you know, the fact of, people hear that kind of language out in the real world anyway, and they diffused it by singing about it very early. There's a song that is almost exclusively a list of sexual acts at the very top of the show. There's another one that is a list of drugs. It's just drugs. And those kinds of things, once you got them out of the way, then the audience could sort of relax into a show that was really about the characters that you were meeting in the course of the evening. And, you know, they were barefoot and they didn't look scary. You were wearing a lot of clothes. They weren't necessarily, especially at the end of the first act. And so those kinds of things put you in a position of relative power to the people on stage. And, you know, it's hard to feel threatened by that.
I'm glad you mentioned an act where a song essentially that was just a list of drugs. I want to play some music, and we're going to try to do that a lot this hour because, of course, it's a musical. So one of the earlier numbers from the show is called Hashish. And it's not so much a song as it is, as you suggested, a list of possible substances to ingest. So let's listen. So the song Hashish from the musical Hair. Bob Mondello's with us. He's the arts critic for NPR. We're talking about Hair 50 years later. Bob, for those who don't know the story, remind us, tell us, what is this musical about?
The story.
Yeah, the story, the plot.
Okay. Well, basically, there's a guy named, who is it? Is it Claude?
Claude, right.
Who is being drafted. And who doesn't like the idea, and it's a worrisome thing. He goes to his draft board and things like that. That story is pretty much the sum total of where the musical was going. It was about, you know, this was a show that was proudly anti the war in Vietnam. And but his story, every time it's threatened to start making a point, was interrupted by other stories, the other characters, and you'd get people walking to the front of the stage and singing a song that was essentially irrelevant to the story at hand, but was talking about their own feelings. Diane Keaton at one point starts singing, Diane Keaton, unknown at the time. This
amazing.
Is before Annie Hall.
Yeah. I completely forgot about that. It's amazing that she was in that. Yeah.
Yeah, she was. And I saw it back then and was sort of blown away by everybody, but Diane Keaton didn't mean anything to me at the time. I wish she had. But she starts singing about liking to date black men. And this is, you got to remember, the show opened like 3 weeks after the death of Martin Luther King. There had just been riots in major American cities. People were frightened at the idea of the civil rights movement. And here was a show where it was treating it irreverently, treating it as you know, it was an integrated cast. It was a show that just sort of went there. And again, it wasn't threatening the way it happened. It felt nice. It felt affirmative. It was about love. And it was really hard to be upset about that.
Bob, what kind of precedents did Hair set? I mean, what followed it and how did it influence what followed it?
Well, what I said before about it being different from the shows that were around it. If you think about Man of La Mancha or Hello, Dolly, those are shows that are written in a specific style and that were afraid of rock music. When Broadway had previously dealt with rock music, the thing that comes to mind is Bye Bye Birdie,
right,
where you had an Elvis-like character. After that, you could do Dreamgirls, you could do Jesus Christ Superstar, you could do all kinds of other things that were in Greece, shows that used rock music.
All right. We're going to take a break. With me is NPR's arts critic Bob Mondello. We're talking about the iconic rock musical Hair, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. You can join the conversation. What does the musical mean to you? Did you see it when it first came out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go out with the original cast recording of Walking in Space. At this point in the show, the character Claude is acting out his visions from an acid trip. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
My soul is in orbit with God face to face, floating, flipping, flying, tripping, tripping from Pottsville to
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, starshine.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Good Morning Starshine from the original cast recording of the iconic rock musical Hair. We're talking about the show's legacy 50 years after it debuted. You can join the conversation. Do you think this musical changed Broadway for the better, maybe for the worse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Bob Mondello, arts critic for NPR. And Bob, I want to read you something from our listener comments on our website. Mm-hmm. Hello Kitty 0580 writes, I love Hair. I discovered the musical when I was 13 via the Simpsons episode where Marge's hair starts falling out. From that point on, my brother, cousins, and I would constantly rock out to the soundtrack.
That's great.
I love that comment. So let's take a couple of calls. Diane is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Diane, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you. I saw Hair on Broadway shortly after it opened. I was about 25, I think, at the time. And I went with some friends. My husband and I went with some friends. And our thing was that it was an anti-war musical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the tenor of the times was such that, in a way, the musical was making the whole anti-war movement less threatening, not more threatening, because it was a softer sell. The people, as somebody said earlier in the program, were lovable.
That was Bob. Yep, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And these were cuddly anti-war protesters. They weren't vehement. They weren't burning flags or burning anything else. They weren't, yes, it went with the hell no, we won't go kind of thing, but it did it in a friendly manner. And I think that the part of the reason it was so acceptable was that it put all of those of us who were young and anti-Vietnam War in a comfortable position relative to our elders at the time.
Diane, thanks so much for that call. Bob, what do you think about what Diane said? I mean, yeah, it was at a time when foment against the Vietnam War was beginning to take off and bubble pretty,
right.
Yeah, pretty extremely.
And other forms of theater, if you were talking about plays, both off-Broadway and on-Broadway, there were some very strong anti-war sentiments expressed in plays of that era. But, you know, musicals hadn't done that, and musicals are where the biggest audience is for Broadway. So that, you know, a Broadway play playing at the Lincoln Center or someplace like that is not going to have the same kind of impact, even if it's well received and generally quite popular. It's not going to be popular the way that a musical is. And this show, its music made it all over the world. It was a phenomenally successful piece, and people got the general drift of, you know, the anti-war sentiments of it. Absolutely, that's what happened.
Bob, I want to introduce from Syracuse, New York, Eric Grody. He's the author of Hair, the Story of the Show That Defined a Generation, and the director of the Gold Ring Arts Journalism Program at Syracuse University. You can find a link to his recent article for the New York Times on the 50th anniversary of the musical at our website, On Point Radio. Eric Grody, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're just the guy we need to talk to during this hour. Can you talk us through a little bit about how Hair came to be? Tell us about the three guys behind the musical and how they came up with the idea and put it on the stage.
Sure. Well, it really started with two guys, James Rado and Jerome Jerry. Everyone called him Jerry Ragney. They were both actors who dabbled in the experimental downtown scene, which Hair, you know, clearly feels sprung up in some ways from that. But also, Rado in particular had performed on Broadway in things like The Lion and Winter, and you know, had sort of like the mainstream cred. And I feel like both of those strains you can really feel in the show in its final iteration. There were a bunch of iterations. They worked on it for several years, in many cases just writing down pieces of, you know, snippets of lyrics or things they overheard. It took the Public Theater, which was a brand new theater in 1967, that Joseph Papp was the impresario, to kind of bring some, I don't want to say grown-ups in the room because they were grown men, obviously, but people who had a more of a keen eye towards structure and shaping it all. The main one being the composer, Galt McDermott, who'd won an Emmy a few years ago, a Grammy, sorry, a few years ago. And, you know, Rado and Ragney looked at the part. They had long hair. They were wild guys. And at the time, Galt lived in Staten Island. He had a wife and four kids and a crew cut. I mean, he just had a completely different vibe from the other two. And people wondered if it would mesh, and I think it really did. I think McDermott and then also Gerald Friedman, the original director, helped kind of impose order on something that was fairly chaotic.
Did any of these guys, I mean, did Rado and Ragney or Galt, I mean, did they realize at the time that they were putting something together that was going to really take off? Or were they as surprised as anyone that this took off?
I don't think anyone could have predicted that it was that it was this huge. I mean, I think they were passionate about, as you and Bob mentioned, you know, the Vietnam War was paramount in their minds, and it was designed as giving voice to these sentiments, you know, in a way that was goofy and appealing and inoffensive enough that it could find an audience. I mean, I found an interview that Joe Papp gave in the early 70s where he said that Hair was marvelous for middle-aged people. they said, oh, that's the reason my son is that way.
So it provided them a key in understanding the younger generation.
Yeah. Interesting.
Listen, I want to play some more music because one of the more controversial aspects of the show at the time when it hit the stage in 1968 was that it had a racially integrated cast and its suggestion that young white women might want to date young black men. So let's listen to a little bit of the number Black Boys.
Once I tried a diet of quiet rest, no sweets, but I went nearly crazy, and I went nearly crazy, because I really crave for chocolate-flavored treats.
Oh, Black Boys are nutritious, baby, Black Boys fill me up.
The song Black Boys from Hair, and it's worth mentioning that this number from the original cast recording features the then unknown Diane Keaton. But Eric Grody, can you talk about that and the significance of a racially integrated cast at that time on the stage?
Sure. I mean, at the time, Ebony magazine called it, quote, unquestionably the biggest outlet for black actors in the history of the American theater.
Huh.
And I think that is true. It didn't always go as smoothly as that. As Bob mentioned, Martin Luther King's assassination was just a few weeks prior. There was a cast member who actually died in an apartment fire. He was, you know, in the hospital for about 2 weeks. When he finally died, the funeral service was for the next day, and the African American performers, in particular, wanted to cancel the next day's performance. The producers didn't. I mean, I think it was pushed late enough, or the service was early enough that everyone could attend the service. But then the show went on, and they were very angry about it. And basically, the entire African American portion of the cast boycotted the performance. And so for that one performance, Hair was performed with an all-white cast, including, if you know the lyrics and material, things that would sound very strange coming from a white performer's mouth.
That's really, really interesting. Interesting historical detail there. Listeners, we're talking about 50 years of Hair, the Broadway musical that first hit the stage on Broadway in 1968. With me, Bob Mondello, NPR arts critic, and Eric Grody, author of Hair, the story of the show that defined a generation. You can get in on the conversation. Tell us your story about Hair at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Pamela. She's calling from New Orleans. Pamela, good to have you.
Hi, Andy. How are you?
I'm very well. What's on your mind? Go ahead.
I'm just calling because I did the show in 93, 94, 94, like right when I got out of high school. And I just wanted to say that it's not so much a show that's like took over the world, but with its like radical music and stuff, but it's also a show that creates a great family. Every person that I did that show with, I am friends with, and it's not just like Facebook friends. We call each other on our birthdays. When I go home to visit, we have dinner. It creates a great family of people who love each other. And, you know, being naked on stage with a bunch of people only makes you closer.
Pamela, thanks so much for that. So that was in the 1990s. Eric, what about how this play has endured? There have been revivals. It still gets put on stage at theaters large and small, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's done all the time. And I've heard performer after performer say exactly what we just heard there, that the sense of community that tends to pop up within casts, or tribes, as they will sometimes call themselves, is long-lasting and very, very intense. I mean, I think part of what makes the show so popular over the years is that feeling of goodwill that we're describing in different ways really often begins with the cast and then permeates out to the audience, and it's palpable often.
Yeah. Bob, how do you think the musical has aged? And does it still resonate today in certain ways?
Well, you know, it's been done again on Broadway a couple of times, and certainly it's done in colleges and high schools all over the place. Although I was talking to some people who were doing it at a regional theater here in Washington, the Studio Theater, and I remember talking to the director and saying that he had to tell the cast, none of whom had been born during the war in Vietnam, about the war in Vietnam and about the draft and about all kinds of things that they simply had no reference point for. I mean, this was historical the way, for me, World War I and World War II are historical. So it was a very different, but I think it's aged fine. It's a period piece. There's no question about that. But
right.
I think you can certainly still do it.
If I could interject quickly.
Please.
There's a sequence where they are deliberating whether to burn the draft cards. Many of the people do, mm-hmm. and it's whether Claude will burn his draft card or not. What audiences don't realize now, because why would they? It's, you know, 50 years ago, is that there was a you could go to prison for 5 years for burning your draft card at that point. And so the recent revival that Bob alluded to, they actually added a quick line of dialogue to contextualize just what a big deal that was.
Oh, how smart. Interesting.
Really interesting.
Yeah, on some level, you do have to kind of explain parts of the show today. Although the vast majority of it, I think, just sort of works.
Let's go to Lewis, who's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Lewis, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm glad that I can speak with you. No, Hair spoke to me because it was something that was not involved with vested interest. I felt that we had voices out there that should be heard. And because of that, I was very, very open about it.
Now, Lewis, did your first experience with Hair, was it back in 1968 when it first hit the Broadway stage?
When it came to Los Angeles.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, Lewis, thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. Let's move on and talk to Pat in Waterville, Maine. Pat, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. I lived in Memphis when Hair was performed at what was then the Memphis State University. It's University of Memphis now, but it was 1970, and Memphis was a very very conservative place, and Hair was pertinent to what we're going through politically. It was exciting. It was controversial. I was a senior in high school, and my friends and I went and waited for hours to get tickets. We memorized the lyrics to the songs, and it was like a rite of passage. It was really wonderful. It changed our lives.
Well, Pat, I love hearing that experience that you had with Hair. Thanks so much for the call. Bob and Eric, I want to play a little more music. So this comes from another part of the show that I understand at the time unsettled some of the audiences in 1968 because it was not entirely respectful. It conveyed a less than totally respectful attitude toward the American flag. So let's listen a little bit to Don't Put It Down, in which members of the tribe are paying the flag a sort of satirical tribute. Here we go.
Don't put it down. Best one around, crazy for the red, blue, and white, crazy for the red, blue, and white. You look at me, what do you see? Crazy for the white, red, and blue.
And that's the song Don't Put It Down from the original cast recording of Hair. Eric Grody, listening to that song, Don't Put It Down, crazy for the red, blue, and white, a little satirical, a little not totally respectful. Tell us a little bit about that song and how it was received.
Well, that you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, people talk about the nude scene, people talk about the drug content. Hair got into a lot of trouble, especially when it left New York and started touring around the country. It ended up to two different Supreme Court cases that dealt with whether it was met obscenity standards. The thing that got people the most riled up, I think, was that song, and there was some treatment of the U.S. flag during that, where they stressed that it never touched the ground, but at the same time, they were being less than fully respectful to the flag. Mm. While writing the book, I talked to one of the Apollo 13 astronauts, James Lovell, who made headlines at the time for storming out of the theater when that scene happened. It's not quite true. He actually left at intermission, you know, went out to smoke and never went back in. But I also did my research. I found out that the lunar module on Apollo 13, you know, the one that they landed and kept them alive, was named Aquarius.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Ah. Yeah. You know, the thing to remember is that there were 500,000 men and women served in the war in Vietnam. So that treating the flag less than respectfully, that was a big chunk of the American public who would theoretically at least have been somewhat offended by that.
Yeah.
So I think I'm generalizing, and there are lots of different attitudes in lots of different places in American society, but that was a different era. And, you know, we had fairly recently come out of World War II as well, so that this kind of disrespect, both for the flag and a satirical treatment of the anti-war movement, I mean, being an anti-war show those were both, they had a different resonance then than they might have today.
Right. Eric, I'd love to ask you the same question that I asked Bob toward the top of the hour. How did this show influence the theater world overall going forward?
Well, one thing you saw, which you see a lot of the time when there's a hit show, are a lot of bad carbon copies of that show. So it became very hard to hear the kind of shows that Bob had in that beautiful montage he had earlier this week. A lot of musicals were trying to sound like Hair and not doing a very good job of it. In the immediate aftermath of Hair, it really wasn't until Jesus Christ Superstar in Greece a few years later that people started to get it right. But rock definitely took over Broadway for a while, for better and often for worse at that.
Interesting. We're talking about the rock musical Hair, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We'll go out of this segment with Nina Simone's famous medley of two songs from Hair, Ain't Got No and I Got Life, which she released in 1968. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Ain't got no mother, ain't got no sweets, ain't got no ticket, ain't got no token, ain't got no mind, ain't got no land. But there is something I've got, there is something I've got, there is something I've got, nobody can take away. I got my hair on my head, got my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, my nose, got my
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What a piece of work is man. How noble in reason. How infinite in faculties. In form and moving. How express and admirable.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're listening to What a Piece of Work is Man from the original cast recording of the rock musical Hair. We're talking about the legacy of the show as it celebrates its 50th anniversary just last month. You can join the conversation. What does this show mean to young people today? Is the spirit of protest still alive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Bob Mondello, arts critic for NPR, and Eric Rohde, author of Hair, the story of the show that defined a generation. And Bob and Eric, I want to read something that a listener put on our website. Jay Poe wrote, I was 9 when Hair hit Broadway. What's interesting about this is this is my generation. That's about the age I was. My parents took me to see Fiddler on the Roof, but not Hair because there was nudity. But we listened to the record all the time as a family. I would sing along and the adults would chuckle. I love that comment, Eric and Bob, because I remember the same thing. I never saw the play, but boy, do I remember the music sort of defining the soundtrack of my childhood home when I was around 9 or 10. Eric, tell me about one of your favorite songs, I understand, Frank Mills.
I love Frank Mills. It's not exactly a hard rocking song. It was this one of the strangest things about this show is that they were rehearsing before they even had a Broadway theater. So while they were rehearsing, people were coming in and watching what they were doing. They would always stop what they were rehearsing at that moment and skip to the scene with Frank Mills because they knew it was such a crowd pleaser. I just think it's a charming little song. It was based on a letter to that was in the Village Voice. And they saw that and basically set it to music.
All right, wait, hold that thought. Let's listen to a little bit of Frank Mills, and then we'll talk about it more. Here it is.
I met a boy called Frank Mills on September 12th right here in front of the Waverly. But unfortunately, I lost his address. He was last seen with his friend, a drummer. He resembles George Harrison of the Beatles, but he wears his hair tied in a small bow at the back.
So sweet. Eric Rohde, tell me more about that song. It was based on a letter you said to a newspaper.
Well, for the longest time, I talked to James Rado about this. They thought it was based on this letter that had run in the Village Voice, and it was. That's where Rado and Ragney had seen it. Years later, they found a British rock music from a full year earlier had had a bunch of personal ads, and one line and here, one line there, had all of those bits of Frank Mills that somebody at the Village Voice had mashed them all into one fake ad that ran in the Voice. But I just think the song is so charming, and I love this idea that in 1968 you would still have to contextualize that it's George Harrison of the Beatles.
Yeah, really interesting. Bob, I'm wondering, when you were thinking about this musical 50 years later, I'm sure you went back and listened to all the music again. Mm-hmm. What struck you? What stood out? How did it hold up?
Well, I'm really glad you played the bit that you just did before Frank Mills, which is that that Shakespearean song, because the only reason I know that passage from Shakespeare, and I was a theater critic for 40 years. I've seen all of Shakespeare's plays, but I can recite that one only by singing it, right? Because I know that bit from the musical. You know, they went on, Eric, I'm not sure about this, but wasn't the next thing they did an adaptation of Shakespeare? It was Two Gentlemen of Verona?
Just Galt. Galt and some of the other people did Two Gentlemen of Verona with John Guare, the playwright, actually, which is a blast.
Yeah, it's a wonderful show. That was that was one of the next things I saw, and was also sort of rock oriented. I mean, what he wrote. So anyway, what I think about when I listen to this music, and one of the things I did, I went into my I've got 500 record albums, you know, vinyl of shows from back then, and I stopped collecting them because it got really expensive too. But one of the things I did was go back and listen to a lot of things from that era. And, you know, Cabaret had just opened, so it wasn't as if there wasn't anything adventuresome going on Broadway besides Hair. But Hair was way out there, right? And it's striking how different it is from even the show that beat it at the Tony Awards that year, which was 1776. That it just doesn't feel like a Broadway musical. And what Eric was saying before about how they couldn't get that feel again in another show for quite a few years is absolutely true. It took forever before they figured out what to do with rock music, and forever being like 3 years, I guess, because Jesus Christ Superstar did it right, but that was an album first.
Yeah.
Right? And really, it was it went from the album to Broadway.
And by the way, if you watch the Tony Awards of that broadcast of that year, the Broadway community, the derision and sneering that's directed toward Hair, which had been running for a year at that point and contributing quite a bit to Broadway's economic health, is kind of shocking to see.
So, Bob, Eric, stand by, because I want to introduce another voice. Joining us now from Burlington, Vermont, is someone who's performed that song we were just listening to, Frank Mills, many, many times.
Wow.
She's Emma Chaffee. She's a senior at Burlington High School, and she recently finished a run playing Chrissy in Very Merry Theater's production of Hair in Burlington. She also wrote about what the musical means to her for the Burlington Free Press, and you can read that at onpointradio.org. Emma Chaffee, great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your perspective. What does this musical mean to you? Why did you want to get involved with it?
Yeah, so I have been a humongous fan of Hair since I was in seventh grade, when Very Merry Theater actually did it for the first time. And so my friends and I went to that show, and I just fell like head over heels in love with the story and the music. It was just totally unlike anything I'd heard before.
What did you love about it? I mean, in what way specifically did it speak to you?
Yeah, so I think back then, I don't think I really realized it, but I think that really exciting, sort of empowering feeling probably came from my sense of feeling like a part of a movement for the first time. Hmm. And that really hit me this year when I did it. Now at age 18, I realized that connection. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think the show relates to young people today? I mean, you know, we've seen some young activism recently in the wake, for example, of the terrible shootings in Parkland, Florida. Yeah. I mean, did you sort of connect that kind of youth movement that in a way Hare spoke to back in 1968 that might resonate today?
Yeah, for sure. And I think during the last song of Let the Sunshine In, every night, everyone was crying, holding hands. And I think that's probably one of the most authentic and powerful moments I've ever felt on stage, because I know that we're all thinking of Black Lives Matter, the Women's March, of March for Our Lives. And specifically March for Our Lives, I think, really parallels Hare, in that, like, in Hare, all of the teens are like, all right, the adults aren't really getting things done. They don't have the right motivation. We're going to stand up and we're going to do this. And I think that the youth of Parkland and the youth of Chicago with the March for Our Lives have really done that wonderfully. And that's a really cool parallel.
Emma Chaffee, you express yourself so well. Eric Grody, what do you hear in Emma Chaffee's story and the way Hare resonates so meaningfully to her today?
I hear exactly what I expected to hear, but also hope to hear, which is that it still can, you know, even if some of the cultural references take a little explaining, or you have to talk about who Allen Ginsberg was, you know, for example, a lot of the stuff, I wish, let me put it this way, I wish Hare was a completely archaic museum piece that didn't resonate in any way. But
yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, interesting. Mm. Bob, your response to what you heard from Emma?
I think she sounds wonderful, and I actually want to hear her. Would you please do for me, the Frank Mills song has a great twist at the end. Can you do that for me right now? Just because I want the audience to hear the twist.
Just sing the end?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Wait, so it's, so she's talking about this guy, Frank Mills, and at the end she says, if you see him, tell him that I'm in the park with my girlfriend, and please tell him Angela and I don't want the $2 back, just him. It's a really cute ending.
Oh, I love that.
That's fantastic. Emma Chaffee, senior at Burlington High School. She played Chrissy in a production of Hare last month by the Very Merry Theater in Burlington. Emma, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure having you. And thank you for singing. Bob Mandela, what an inspired request. Thank you for singing for us.
Of course.
All right, great. Have a great day. Let's go to some other callers who want to get in on this great conversation about Hare 50 years later. Alex is calling from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I fell in love with Hare through the movie when I was in high school, and I'm currently a music professor in my 40s. And along the way, I've taught a course in the history of rock music, and I wanted to comment on the two songs that now, in my relationship with the musical, I find the most interesting and substantive. And the first one is Frank Mills. I think it really illustrates the childlikeness of the people that were involved in this movement, and that so many of these people really were just kids sort of exploring the way that they're going to relate to the world. I love its construction. I love the fact that it doesn't rhyme. I think it's a beautiful melody. But since we talked about that, I just wanted to talk more about what I find currently the most powerful song in the play for me is Easy to Be Hard, which is where this exploration of freedom and releasing yourself from your bindings and your families and finding new families, it really meets with the reality of the necessary responsibility of being an adult.
Alex, and I'm really glad you brought up this song. It just so happens that this is one of the songs we've got queued up. So let's listen to that for a little bit. This is Easy to Be Heard, sung in the original cast recording by Lynn Kellogg.
How can people be so heartless? How can people be so cruel? Easy to be hard. Easy to be cold. Oh, how can people have no feelings? How can they ignore their friends? Easy to be proud. Easy to say no.
Easy to Be Hard from Hair. I incorrectly said Easy to Be Heard. Easy to Be Hard. Eric Grody, do you want to talk about this song?
I mean, it's that one fits more in the sort of, you know, four beats to a measure rock tune. It's a good song. It's one of the many we've alluded to. I think there were about 700 singles that that got launched from this show. But I think the previous caller, you know, kind of nailed it.
Yeah, I really did. Let's take a couple, one more call. Hope is calling from East Lyme, Connecticut. Hope, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say I went when I was 16, and my 19-year-old friend, Marine Corps, that came home that day. We lived in New York, and he took me to the Hair, the show. I don't know if he even knew what it was. But it opened a conversation that is still going on. I married him. He's a disabled vet. And I think that show helped him share with me what happened to him in Vietnam. I was a war protester. Even though I was 16, we had student strikes at our high school. And I think the show helped us bridge these two extremes that we were experiencing.
Well, Hope, thanks so much for telling us that story, and we wish you all the best. I'm really grateful that you called in. Eric Grody, in just the minute or so that we have left, what are your hopes for this musical? I mean, we heard that wonderful story from Emma Chaffee, who's still performing it up in Burlington, Vermont. Is this a play that still has currency and the ability to go on the stage and speak to audiences?
I think it does. I mean, as long as you've got young people who kind of like Emma said, are motivated and feel like they've got the energy and the will to try to make things happen that should have happened but haven't yet, I feel like this is one of the best chronicles we have of you know, just sort of youth and all its passion and energy, and it's sometimes messy and very, very powerful.
Bob Mondello, final thought from you. What do you sort of look for? What do you look forward to in thinking about Hair as it, I don't know, can it live another 50 years?
Well, I won't be around to see that, I'm afraid, but I can imagine seeing it in another 20 and enjoying it again afresh, and hopefully it won't be quite as current.
Right, not quite as current. Well, listen, I want to thank you both for joining us. Bob Mondello is an arts critic for NPR. You can find a link to his piece for NPR's Morning Edition on the 50th anniversary of Hair at our website, On Point Radio. Bob Mondello, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in today.
This was great talking to you again, Anthony.
Really appreciate it. And Eric Grody is the author of Hair, the story of the show that defined a generation, and the director of the Gold Ring Arts Journalism Program at Syracuse University. You can find a link to his recent article for the New York Times on the 50th anniversary of the musical at our website, onpointradio.org. Eric, really appreciate your time today. Thank you for coming in. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure, and great job, Emma.
I second that. Many thanks to Emma Jaffe, who joined us early in the hour. Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we'll go out today with the Hair show finale, a medley of The Flesh, Failures, and Let the Sun Shine In. Have a great weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Listening for the new time.